I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Most of us think about the International Monetary Fund as a group of men in dark suits who worry about budgetary issues in Buenos Aires. Somber, unsmiling people who gather to talk about the timing of loans to Ukraine or Haiti. So people sat up and took notice last week when the IMF released a report pointing its finger at the United States. The IMF says growing budget deficits and Washington's determination to press on with tax cuts and the resulting growth of the U.S. debt should be a worry not just for people in this country, but for overall global financial stability. The IMF warning came just days after the former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury, Robert Rubin, delivered his own color alert. Rubin says there's enough red ink now that, quote, the risk of severe adverse consequences must be taken very seriously. This hour on The Connection, Robert Rubin joins us to talk about just what those consequences might be for the U.S. economy and everyone who depends on it. And here's our question, what does this financial red alert really mean? What are the long-term implications of the Bush administration's tax and budget policies for ordinary people? And if the U.S. situation threatens the financial stability of the world, then what's the fix? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be turning to Robert Rubin in just a moment, though. First, a couple of minutes with Elizabeth Becker. She's a reporter with the New York Times, and she's been covering these latest warnings. Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Hello. Nice to be here.
You wrote that the IMF's concern is that the U.S., and I'm going to quote what you wrote here, is running up a foreign debt of such record-breaking proportions that it threatens the financial stability of the global economy. And I mean, look at the words, threatens the financial stability of the global economy. It's pretty severe stuff.
And the one aspect that you didn't mention in your introduction was the trade imbalance. It's not just our budget deficit, mm-hmm. but the growing trade imbalance. And it's those twin deficits that the fund brought attention to. And yes, however, it's not the first time the IMF has mentioned this, but it's the first time they've gone to such lengths to say, not only is this a problem, but they don't see the solution.
You also noted that the IMF went to considerable lengths to make sure that this particular report got noticed and got coverage. What did they do?
Well, they made sure that all of us reporters knew that they were bringing out the report and that they would be available for a telephone press conference. Moreover, they sent us the report in advance so we would have plenty of time to read and digest it and be able to ask good questions. And then during the actual press conference, one of the authors, Charles Collins, said to me that one of the things he was happy about was that these issues are now being discussed in the presidential campaign. So I think part of it was they wanted as broad a debate as possible to get across the point that they are concerned. And they're concerned because with these deficits, the United States continues to have to borrow. And that borrowing is what's going to affect us and the rest of the world.
The IMF and the U.S. worked so much like partners in the past. And, I mean, that's a part of the area that I'll be talking about with Robert Rubin in just a moment. But I guess I need your assessment, Elizabeth. When one of those partners, the IMF, turns around and points such an accusatory finger at the United States, is that in your mind what's so unusual here?
Well, yes. And in the sense that the United States is the biggest, you know, the most powerful member of the fund, the one thing that IMF economists can do is bring it to the public's attention. Because, for instance, in terms of developing nations like Argentina, they depend on the fund for loans. Obviously, that's not the case with the United States. They're one of the major funders. So, yes, it's important because that's the one leverage the fund has. And the fund is in charge of not the United States, but the entire global financial system and keeping it stable, keeping loans and interest rates, all that sort of thing, keeping it stable. And so they're saying, yes, we're worrying about the stability of the global system.
And the fact that they won't be able to turn to the United States and say, hey, we need help with this country.
No. Exactly.
Elizabeth, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Elizabeth Becker's a reporter with the New York Times. Now, Robert Rubin, as I said earlier, has pulled the curtain back on his own work as U.S. Secretary of Treasury in his new book. It's called In an Uncertain World. He is now working as a senior executive of Citigroup in New York, and he's joining us from a studio in New York City. Robert Rubin, it's good to have you on The Connection.
Very good to be with you. Thank you, Dick.
Severe adverse consequences. Those are harsh words. That's language that you wouldn't have used as Treasury Secretary.
Well, I would have used it where it was appropriate, and I think in this instance it's appropriate. I think that we've created a situation where it is very likely that at some point down the road, since we've been borrowing from the future to pay for the present, a day of reckoning will come, and we will indeed have exactly what I described there.
What would you put your finger on as a severe adverse consequence that I should pay attention to, that people listening should pay attention to?
Well, I think, Dick, that the probability is high that with the track that we're on right now, that at some point down the road, we will have a very substantial increase in interest rates for a whole host of reasons, and that when that happens, that in turn will have a severe adverse effect, or is likely to have a severe adverse effect on economic growth. It's likely to undercut new job creation, result in job loss, undercut standards of living, and in general have a severely adverse impact on American economic conditions in this country, and I might add abroad, which is why I think the IMF has gotten so concerned.
Now, Elizabeth mentioned that one of the IMF officials said that he was pleased that this was finally getting the sort of attention that it is. But I need you to kind of reflect on where you are right now. Wall Street seems to be pumping along at a pretty good pace with the stock indices as high as everybody says they ought to be. Interest rates are remaining low. I'm wondering whether or not you think the warnings are going to stick when people look at the current indicators of the health of the economy.
Well, I think it's a very good question, and I think it's a multi-layer question, actually. In terms of the stock market, if you go around and you talk to Wall Street forecasters, and because I'm in this world, I have a lot of exposure to people who do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
They take into account earnings projections and current interest rates, and they discount them back, as you know, and that gives them some basis for making a judgment about the market. I think it's fair to say that this prospect, this overhanging prospect of very substantial and deeply troubling long-term fiscal deficits is simply not part of their calculation. And in fact, Dick, it's very hard to know how to figure that in exactly because, as you say, interest rates right now are low and have been low for the last 3 years, and I think that's because the private demand for investment capital has been relatively low. I think your problem comes when the private demand for capital for investment becomes strong again, and that collides with the government's demand for capital, and then the markets begin to look forward to this never-ending array of very substantial and unfortunately increasing long-term deficits. And at some point is when it seems to me very highly probable these adverse effects will occur. But until then, I don't think the stock market, it's hard to know what will happen, but at least so far the stock market has not known how to factor that in and therefore has ignored it. And I think it's fair to say that the same thing is true with respect to the bond market.
Do these things really sneak up even on people who are experts? I'm thinking of a column that Paul Krugman wrote where he was noting your particular concern about the state of affairs right now. And he went so far as to say, you know, everyone in Argentina said life will be fine, we won't have any problems, and the same sort of thing could happen here. Would you go so far as to say that the U.S. could go the way of Argentina, wake up some morning and find out that the dollar is worth half or less what it was the night before?
Well, I think you're raising two different questions, and I think it's actually an extremely important question. It's not that it will sneak up in the sense that there isn't an awareness of this problem. It's, you know, you and I are discussing this right now on your show.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I think it is true that people do not internalize this problem. They don't take it. They don't weigh it in making their judgments about markets and economic conditions and all the rest, until you get to the point where it all of a sudden hits. And if you look back over the whole history of long-term fiscal conditions, it isn't that they're not foreseen. It's not that people haven't provided warnings during all the 80s, for example, that we were really getting into a terribly difficult situation fiscally. But that was largely ignored by markets, by investors, by people involved in business, until the effects started to be felt. And then once they were felt, then all of a sudden there was enormous attention being paid to it, and I think that's kind of what's going on now.
But we're then all victim of the political aspect of trying to make sense of fiscal policy and monetary policy, because at the same time you're raising real concerns here, the current administration is saying, we don't have a problem. We can take care of our budget deficits as soon as we choose to do that. So, I mean, I, as an ordinary person, can choose to listen to your warnings or choose to listen to the good news. And guess where my attention ends up?
Well, and I think that's a little bit of what has happened over the whole history of debates about fiscal matters. That is to say that if you're an administration that chooses to put a rose-colored view on life, you can do that, and that does, tends to have a very substantial effect on how the public sees this issue. And unfortunately, the result is that there really is relatively little public understanding of this issue and very little public energy, political energy, around seriousness of purpose and reestablishing long-term fiscal discipline. And in, unless we can get that kind of public understanding and public energy, my instinct is to think that it is at least possible and probably likely that instead of dealing with this ahead of time and fending off or preventing these kinds of severe effects, we probably won't deal with them until they occur. And that, I think, is most unfortunate.
Well, I hope we get an opportunity this hour to do some of that public involvement that you're talking about. Our telephone number here is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest this hour, Robert Ruman, former Secretary of the Treasury. We're talking about recent reports from Mr. Ruman and his colleagues, as well as from the IMF, that the United States' current budget picture is dire enough to raise questions about the stability, global financial stability. We're going to take our first call from Amherst, Massachusetts. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I have a friend of mine who manages a market fund, and he's been warning me about this for about a year, about the policies of our government leading to a devaluation of our currency on overseas markets, and this creating a pent-up potential for a sudden devaluation in the U.S. of our currency, meaning rapid inflation at some point. And he's been shorting real estate trusts and moving his money into gold, and he's actually pretty scared. And I'm really glad that it's finally becoming, in effect, public knowledge with this warning from the IMF, because he's been forecasting disaster.
And you see it coming, Michael, yourself? You think he's right?
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the way the euro's been climbing in value versus the American dollar, and now we're starting to see the price of gasoline start to go up. I mean, that's because, you know, oil is traded overseas in dollars and not in, say, euro or gold. And it's finally coming home to roost that the dollar is going down and down and down in value in overseas markets. And it's only a matter of time before the chickens come home to roost.
Michael, I want to thank you for your call. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. We're going to take a very quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk to Robert Ruman about just what the hint or the signs of a dropping dollar should be for us, because it certainly is, as Michael is saying, dropping against the euro and other world currencies. What kind of an indicator is that? And what's the long-term view? And what's the long-term fix? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me this hour, Robert Ruman, former U.S. Treasury Secretary, author of a new memoir. It's called In an Uncertain World, Tough Choices from Wall Street to Washington. Mr. Ruman is currently a director of Citigroup. He's joining us from a studio in New York City. And I'll go straight to you, Mr. Ruman, on the question that we left, and that is, how are we to make sense of what's happening to the value of the U.S. dollar? It's easy enough to look at that and say, well, that's great news for American exporters. That's the good side to it. What's the bad side?
Yeah, it's actually a complicated question. And on the comment that the last caller made, I think he raised a very troubling set of questions. If the foreign if the international, but I think there is a caveat I'd like to mention too. If the international capital markets lose confidence in our fiscal policy, and if that loss of confidence is exacerbated by the very large trade deficits that we're running. That combination, the twin deficits that we all remember from the 80s, can undermine confidence in our dollar and can result in a substantial deterioration of the dollar. If that happens gradually over a long period of time, that can help remedy our trade imbalances. If it happens sharply, then that can have very serious adverse effects in terms of foreign providers of capital wanting, or demanding, I should say, much higher interest rates to provide our country with the capital inflows that we need to fund our trade deficit. And so that can have a very substantial upward effect on interest rates and probably as a consequence, a downward effect on the stock market, and that can feed back into the economy and all the rest. The one caveat I would and that is one more reason why it is imperative that we fix our long-term fiscal policy, which unfortunately I see no evidence of happening right now. But on the point your caller made, one cautionary comment I would make is that I do think there's a very serious and high probability risk that these kinds of effects will occur, but there is no telling when. And this money manager friend of his is going short one thing and long another in order to take advantage of it, may very well be positioning himself in a way that works over the long term. But you can have an awful lot happen in the shorter term for all kinds of other reasons that can make life relatively unpleasant while you wait for the long term to happen.
Let me ask you just to look back over your time in Washington. You were just in office when you had to deal with Mexico's currency crisis in 95. You basically stepped from straight from that to problems in Asia and Japan and Russia in 98. When you talk about the market having confidence in a currency, that was your real concern back then. Could you slide enough support to Mexico or to South Korea that the market wouldn't lose confidence and there wouldn't be this sort of run on that country's currency? Those countries, though, Mr. Rubin, are a lot smaller than the United States. And when you talk about investors losing confidence in the U.S. dollar, isn't this an economy which in some way stands separate and apart? I think there's a feeling here in the United States that what might have happened to other smaller, less developed countries could never happen in America.
Well, I don't think that people are – yeah. Well, I don't think that that the point of the IMF report was that we could have an Argentine-style meltdown. But I do think the point of the IMF report – was that you could have very substantial adverse effects on this country's currency, which would mean a decline in the dollar, and on interest rates, which would mean an increase in interest rates, and that all of that could be highly detrimental to our economic interests and to the global economy. And so while it's true that it might – I think almost inconceivable – that it would take on the full dimension of the sort of meltdown that we had in Argentina, mm-hmm. I do think that you could have the kinds of very substantial effects that would be very meaningful in a very negative way, both to our economic well-being, the economic well-being of the world. You may remember, I don't know how well you remember this, but at the end of President Carter's term, when the international markets lost confidence in our currency, the dollar went down and short-term interest rates went to something over 20%.
Oh, I remember that.
That was not a favorable development.
Well, let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
And the situation is much, in some ways, more dangerous today because we are today a large debtor nation internationally, which we weren't then. And we are only a few years away from the beginning of the retirement of the baby boomer generation and then the acceleration in entitlement costs that will come therewith.
The large debtor nation point that you're making to say that more of these decisions could be made outside the United States and affect people in this country. Is that the point?
Yeah, that we could be much more affected by decisions that holders of dollar-denominated instruments around the world make. That's exactly correct. You got it.
Okay. Baton Rouge, Louisiana. David's with us now. And I think, David, this is right on your point, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
One of the justifications for the current policy is that we had deficit spending in the 80s with Ronald Reagan, and we didn't really have any adverse consequences from it. Is that justification appropriate for today, considering that, you know, our economy is different domestically and with the global interconnections?
Yeah, I think the problem with that comment is it's in the neighborhood of 100% wrong. We did have very large deficits during the 80s, and there were people who were deeply concerned about them. I happened to have been one of them. And then you got into 1980. I'm glad you raised the question. That was a very good question to raise. When you got into 1989 and then, of course, much more in 90 and 91, the results, I think, I personally think the pretty much inevitable results of that unsound fiscal policy were borne by the American people, in the sense that we had a very serious slowdown in our economy, a recession, as a matter of fact. And as you may remember, when economic conditions deteriorated badly in 90 and 91, short-term interest rate, or rather interest rates in general, instead of going down the way you would have expected, which would then have promoted recovery, only went down a little bit. They basically stayed about the same. And that was because of this enormous concern at that point about our very seriously troubling long-term fiscal conditions. So I think, in fact, the 80s make precisely the point we're making. It's also interesting, by the way, that you know there was a very large tax cut in 1981. Reagan, to some extent, self-corrected for that in 1982. As you may remember, there was a substantial tax increase. Now, it wasn't nearly enough to prevent the really quite serious negative or adverse fiscal conditions that developed over the 80s, but there was a partial course correction.
David, back to you in Louisiana. Are you seeing a parallel here, or are you hearing the differences that Robert's describing?
Well, I wonder if maybe there's some difference between the way our economy worked then and the way that it works now. I mean, you were mentioning foreign holders of dollar-denominated instruments and baby boomers coming of age to represent people outside of our policy apparatus having control and also new costs. Are there any other differences between then and now that might, change the consequences?
Well, I think the consequences will be heading in the same direction. I think the 80s did lead to what I think was an almost inevitable and I think very much closely caused by the 80s set of adverse economic conditions in the early 90s. But you are correct. There are the two additional factors. We are now a large debtor nation, which exacerbates the issues, and we are coming much closer to the baby boomer the baby boomer retirement. So I would say those are the two biggest changes that would relate to the situation.
Robert, you write in your new book, though, near the end, that under certain circumstances, it might be entirely sensible to run a short-term or a temporary deficit. And as I said earlier in the program, the Bush people say that that's sort of what they're doing. What's the part of the equation here that you want to draw our attention to, though?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that, and as you say it, I do say that in the book, I think that it was entirely appropriate 3 years ago. And in fact, I alluded to this in an op-ed I wrote for the New York Times. I think it was entirely appropriate to put in place short-term stimulus because we were having difficult economic conditions in order to get ourselves back on track economically. But the problem is what we should have done is done that with temporary tax cuts or I think to a greater extent with temporary aid for cities and states for infrastructure and school construction projects that were ready to go because I think that would have been more jobs effective. Had we done that, you could have had all the stimulus you wanted, all the stimulus you wanted in the short term. It would have been far more cost effective for the United States government. It probably would have been more jobs effective. And most importantly, it would have avoided these unnecessary and enormous long-term effects from the current tax cut program that are now creating and are predominantly responsible for what is a very serious and I think dangerous long-term fiscal situation.
Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Bob is on the line there. Hi, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you, Dick. Pleasure for taking my call. Thank you very much. And for Mr. Rubin, I've been a big fan of yours for a long time.
Well, thank you.
I wish I wasn't making this call. I guess two things. One is Mr. Rubin is very right. This is not an easy subject to get your hands around. I think that the last year and a half myself, I've spent a great deal of time having to educate myself. And I've had to do that as a businessman, going to the resources they have available, such as websites, listening to Paul Krugman, but also the Center for Budgetary Policy's Priority, the Citizens for Tax Justice, and also watching and being in contact with our elected officials. And he's absolutely right. I'm concerned as a business person because I guess the best way I can put it is this way. It's sort of like your home equity line. You sort of run up this bill and maybe I have $100,000 one day, and I start keep borrowing against it. But there'll come a time where I'm not going to be able to reinvest in the projects I want to keep my business going. And
Bob, let me ask you, though, because I'm wondering whether or not you think this is enough in the sort of current political debate that we're hearing in the country, either among the Democratic candidates or between Democrats and Republicans. Is this being talked about?
I think the challenge and the question I have is it's a tough subject, and I think I'd like to hear what Mr. Rubin would have to say about that. But I think in a sense, for the 91 election or 92, we had Ross Perot. I remember his charts. But I think it helps bring to bear some very complex issues, which, you know, as he just said, deficits are not always bad. Sometimes you need to have the short-term stimulus. Mm-hmm. What I'm concerned about, especially in the local area, is that our state governments are really hurting, especially for job training cuts in terms of educational areas cuts, which in turn hurts our long-term effectiveness. And I would ask Mr. Rubin, in terms of policy changes, what things can we do, do you think, to get us back on track for longer-term stimulation and job growth?
Well, look, the answer is if everybody understood this as well as you did, we would be in a far better position as a nation because you'd have a very different political context. But unfortunately, it is not the case that people, at least in my judgment, it is not the case that people do. The Ross Perot charts that you mentioned, that's an interesting comment because in 1990 and 91 and 92, I remember that political campaign very well. At that point, we were having very difficult economic conditions, including a recession. And yet interest rates stayed very high. And people recognized, and consumer and business confidence had been undermined in addition, which is yet a further point, by fiscal conditions. And the American people recognized, because they were being affected by it, the tie between that long period of unsound fiscal conditions, the 80s, and what they were experiencing, and that made long-term fiscal responsibility a resonant and effective political force. But unfortunately, although it's being discussed a lot right now, there is no real political energy around it, and people will make they'll speak to it, they'll allude to it, they'll refer to it, but there's not a real seriousness of purpose about it in our political system right now.
Perhaps because aside from all the people who may have lost their jobs over the past 3 or 4 years, there's not a real financial sting in the country over that.
No, and right now the economy is doing well. There's a lot of stimulus in the economy. The tax part of it, I think, was, as I said, constructed horrendously for that purpose and could have been done differently and had exactly the same stimulus. But there is a lot of stimulus. The economy is strong. A lot of people think it'll stay strong. Certainly through the second quarter of this year when the stimulus is still in effect and maybe even through the year or even for the next couple of years. Who knows? But these big issues, these big risks will continue to overhang. And for the reason that we've discussed quite a bit, I think are probably not going to get the attention of the political system until trouble develops, although one would hope that wouldn't be the case.
All right, Bob, thanks for that call. Let's go next to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Sarah's with us. Hi, Sarah, go ahead.
Hi, I've been listening to this, and it occurs to me that Alan Greenspan sets the interest rates in this country. I was wondering if anybody has any idea what his approach to this is, or does he consider this worrisome, or, you know, what is he on to the White House every single day about it, or what? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, I think you've asked the right person. Robert, you still have periodic breakfast meetings with Alan Greenspan and Larry Summers, or at least you're in touch with the other members of the Committee to Save the World.
Well, as I describe in the book, Larry Summers, who's now president of Harvard, but was my deputy secretary at the time, and Alan Greenspan and I used to have breakfast once a week, but we met even more often than that. And it was really I think the fact that we all worked together so well was a very important, made a very important contribution to the effectiveness of our whole economic management economic policy processes at that time. I think two comments I do speak to Greenspan from time to time, but two comments with respect to Greenspan. One, he does not set interest rates, and it's a very interesting thing. He does set he sets the overnight loan rates as between banks, so that all he can set are the very short-term rates, the market interest rates, the 5-year rates and the 10-year rates and what used to be the 30-year rates are affected by what the Federal Reserve Board does, but they can also have very substantial moves independent of what the Federal Reserve Board does. And even if the Federal Reserve Board, and I have no idea what he's going to do. I have zero idea what's on his mind in that respect. But even if he were to keep rates low, his rates, the Fed funds, called the Fed funds rate, his rate low for a long period of time, you could see the 10-year rates, which are what affect mortgage rates, the 10-year government rate, go up very substantially if the markets become deeply concerned about our long-term fiscal condition. Secondly, about I don't know when this was exactly, but roughly 2 months ago, he was giving a speech, and at the end of the speech, he said something to the – this is a paraphrase, not an exact quote – something to the effect that – and he was referring to these very high projected fiscal deficits, and he said that we have to make very tough choices and our future depends on it, and I think that is correct.
But in fairness to Sarah, if you look at interest rates in Canada, if you look at interest rates in Europe, one of the reasons why those currencies are now moving ahead of the American dollar is that the rates are higher. If Mr. Greenspan chose to bump up the federal funds rate, then he could, in fact, increase the interest rate in this country and prop up the dollar a little bit. He's choosing not to do that, though. Why is that?
Well, two comments on that, if I may. I don't actually think you now get into some very complicated questions. I used to, and I described this in the book, I ran trading operations for a long, long time. It's a world I actually know a bit about, including currency trading. I ran a very large currency trading operation one time in my private sector life before going to government. And I described some of that in the book. I think the movements in the currency, you're really talking about the euro versus the dollar.
Yeah, okay.
Have not been a function of relative interest rates. I think they've been a function of what one of your earlier callers raised, which was this concern about our current account deficit and maybe to some extent the beginnings of a reaction to these, I think, very deeply troubling long-term fiscal deficits. So I don't think most of that yet is in people's minds. I don't think it's the relative interest rates. In terms of the Fed, if the Fed were to try to counter, if the Fed were to focus on the currency and were to try to counter what was happening to the dollar by raising interest rates, their interest rates, these very short-term interest rates, that wouldn't necessarily have any effect on long-term rates. It may just be that the 10-year bond rates or the 5-year bond rates would stay the same.
I have to stop you there. We're going to take a short break. Connection listeners, we are back after that break with Robert Rubin. We're talking about the current situation in the United States. Mr. Rubin's got a new book on the market. It's called In an Uncertain World, Tough Choices from Wall Street to Washington. He's drawing our attention to some of those choices today. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. One of Robert E. Rubin's skills when he was Secretary of Treasury, and I'm sure his colleagues at Citigroup would say that's why they're paying him so much money today, is that he says it is always an uncertain world, and as long as you understand it that way, you can make some sensible choices. His new book is called In an Uncertain World, Tough Choices from Wall Street to Washington. We're talking about current situation in the United States, some recent reports from the IMF. Saying that the situation needs specific and direct attention now. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky now, and Andy's next on the line. Andy, thanks for calling.
Hello. Mr. Secretary, thank you for taking my call. My question is, can the U.S. government go bankrupt in the same way that an individual or corporation can? And if so, what happens when that happens? Can a foreign government foreclose, in a sense, on the U.S. Or a bank, can they foreclose on the United States government?
Well, it's a good question. The government itself cannot go bankrupt in the sense that an individual or a company can, but the holders of credit can lose confidence in a government the way they lose confidence in an individual or a corporation, and the consequence gets reflected in the kinds of interest rates that they're going to demand from the government for future borrowing. And that is the kind of a risk that these very large fiscal deficits are now, I think, creating for us at some point down the road.
Andy, there's something that Robert Rubin writes about in his book. He talks about it as moral hazard of intervening in one of the things that they would sit around and do in Washington. Correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, is say, okay, well, if we intervene here, is there a moral hazard that we're just rewarding bad behavior or not teaching anyone a lesson? Is that a fair way of looking at it?
Yeah, I mean, what the book tries to do is to provide a sense of how complicated the kinds of judgments you have to make when you face a crisis in a foreign country, how complicated those judgments are. In the first chapter, it relates how right after the very night that I got sworn in as Secretary of Treasury, after the swearing in, Larry Summers and I turned to President Clinton and we said, Mr. President, there was a very deep crisis developing in Mexico. We think it can have enormous adverse impact on our country, and we strongly recommend that the United States provide very substantial resources to support Mexico as it puts in place the requisite reforms to try to minimize that crisis. And we do so in our interest, but we must tell you that there's no guarantee that it is going to work, and you've got to make a judgment about what the probability is that it will work and what the effects would be if we don't intervene. And furthermore, if it doesn't work, the political impact on you could be horrendous. And his very quick response was, look, it's the right thing to do, and we should do it. In that context, one of the observations we made to President Clinton was that there is a negative to this. There's the unintended, just what you were referring to, the unintended byproduct is that investors may begin to feel that any time they, or creditors, any time that they extend a loan to an emerging market country, if there's trouble, then the United States will step in, and that will make them less careful. We didn't like creating that moral hazard situation, but we felt that was a risk that was worth taking in order to try to prevent this Mexican crisis from accelerating and developing and having a very substantial possible adverse effect on us.
I wonder
all,
if
all of these policy decisions are really complexes, if you will, of very difficult probabilistic weighings and balances. And it's that kind of feel and sense that I try to convey in discussing these various issues in the book.
I wonder if there isn't a hazard on the flip side when you speak in such dire terms about what the economic future of this country could be, that there isn't a feeling in among ordinary people that, yeah, well, if it ever gets that bad, there's going to be a Robert Rubin type character who'll come in and fix it. And therefore, we can listen to this as something that's kind of scary on paper, but there'll always be someone to save us.
Well, let us hope that at the point, leaving me aside for a moment, or not for a moment, period, but let us hope that if we do get to the point, and I think unfortunately there's a good chance we will, where we face the kind of serious issues and adverse effects that you're talking about, that we have in place an administration, a president, and an economic team that are equipped to think thoughtfully and sensibly and seriously about those issues. But there's no magic wand. And at that point, fixing what they will have inherited and that we in this period of time will have created is going to require taking very substantial actions that will have very substantial adverse effects. Probably, I would guess, some combination of some substantial increase in revenues and probably some substantial reductions in expenses. And all of that is going to be very, very painful. And we could have avoided it, and we could still avoid some fair measure of it by acting now to redress our long-term fiscal condition. But unfortunately, the political system doesn't seem to me to be very much focused on doing that in any very serious way.
We talk about market confidence, and I'm wondering when your successor, Paul O'Neill, goes on a national television program and says, I was there as Secretary of the Treasury, and these guys aren't paying attention. The war was planned long in advance. Do those types of comments, can they have an effect on what we're talking about, on the way that the health and strength of the American economy is seen?
Well, you know, I don't really know that much about what Paul. I like and respect Paul O'Neill. I said that when he was in office. I have not read his book, and I really haven't read that much about it. But obviously anything that people say, that current or former public officials say that relates to how investors and businesses here and abroad see our policy regime and see the management of our economic issues can affect confidence in one way or the other.
Let's go to Boston, Massachusetts now. David's next on the line. David, go ahead.
Thank you very much. What a great show and what a wonderful topic you have here today. We keep hearing how the American consumer has fueled the U.S. economy with steady purchases over the last 2 or 3 years. In connection with the national debt, could Mr. Rubin maybe discuss his views on the threat posed to the American economy by rising levels of credit card debt that American families are taking on? And is there some kind of debt trickle-down effect that we could perhaps name that's coming from the debt from the nation being passed on to the individual consumer?
Well, I don't know, unless I misunderstand the question, I don't think it's being passed on to the consumer. I think the point you make is a very good one, which I had not mentioned, nor had any of the other callers. In addition to the federal government's debt, consumer debt is at, roughly speaking, record high levels as a percentage of the economy or percentage of disposable income or percentage of net worth. Now, so far, that has not deterred the consumer from spending, and I rather suspect the reason is that interest rates have come down a great deal, and so the monthly service cost of that debt has come down even while the level of the debt has gone up. But I've had the view, two comments if I may, I've had the view at least that at some point, even if interest rates are low, consumers are going to feel constrained simply by the amount of their debt. Secondly, if interest rates go back up substantially, then to the extent that that consumer debt has variable interest rates instead of fixed interest rates, that all of a sudden would increase the consumer's debt service on what is now a much larger body of consumer debt. And so you could have quite a sharp, you could at least conceivably have quite a sharp impact.
I wonder if I can just nudge this a little bit back into a political understanding of how we are supposed to see the situation in the country. I note that you have raised some concern, Robert, about the way that the public's losing support for market-based policies. We did a program last week marking the 10th anniversary of NAFTA, and I can't tell you how many people called up to say, you know, I hate it, it's not working, it doesn't, it's got no kind of fix or impact in my community, and the emails came on after that program. And I'm wondering if you are concerned, sitting in your office with Citigroup now, the way that the American public appears to be shifting away from any kind of support for some of those policies that were very important to you when you were in Washington.
Oh, I think it's an immense, Dick, I think it's an immense issue that unfortunately very few people raise in the way that you've just framed it, because I think that's the right way to frame it. But it's a complex issue, both substantively and politically. This is not a simple issue. Our country's relatively open markets during the 1990s, in my opinion, contributed substantially to our economic well-being. It kept consumer prices lower, it kept inflation lower, kept interest rates lower, put pressure on American businesses to be more productive, all of which was, I think, greatly to the good. But it is also true that open markets create dislocations, and the breadth of those dislocations is now far wider, or greater, I guess is the right word, greater, because outsourcing means that call centers and software development and even the things like reading x-rays and matters of that, legal research, investment banking research, are being done in countries with very low wage bases and therefore much lower wages, with the information communicated back and forth on a real-time basis due to modern technology. And all that has greatly increased the anxiety. Well, firstly, it has increased the dislocations that are coming from trade, and secondly, even more, increased the anxiety around trade. And I think we do run the risk. I think we have more than just the risk. I think we are having a substantial backlash against trade liberalization. I think the right answer is to stay on the track of trade liberalization. I think the right answer is to have much better programs. And so I think it was a parallel agenda, a strong public education system, strong training programs for those who are dislocated, strong basic research as the base for new industries, and strong fiscal policy to have low interest rates to encourage investment and so forth. And I think protectionism would be highly detrimental and make all of this far worse for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that our competitors would get the same inputs at lower prices for their manufacturing, lower prices than we would, and our trading partners almost surely retaliate against us. But it is a complicated issue, both substantively and politically.
And one of the things that bedeviled your time in Washington and continues to puzzle those of us who try to make sense of what's going on in that city is that you can't separate politics from fiscal policy and politics from monetary policy. And so you'll get Congress swinging one way when perhaps logic says they ought to swing the other way, and the public's left looking at both sides and wondering who's telling the truth.
Yeah, I think it's even a little worse than that. I agree with what you say, but I think it's even a little worse than that. It's even hard to get serious discussion. I think it's very healthy to have a serious debate about these issues with seriousness of purpose around the debate and the pros and cons of all the different points of view laid out so that both people in the political system and the public more generally can try to make decisions. But unfortunately, that very rarely happens. Instead, it tends to be done in ways that I think very substantially misinform the debate and are not designed to lead toward toward optimal answers.
I want to close, if I can, with one of your own.
By the way, it was one of the purposes of my book. It was a hope that the book, in its own very little way, could help to contribute to a better debate and to better public understanding.
Okay, well, let me pluck a line from that book, and this from Larry Summers. He used to smile that one of your favorite lines in a meeting facing a crisis was, "How much time do we have before we have to decide?" So how much time do we have before we have to worry?
Well, I worry right now, but my worry is based on what I think is going to happen somewhere down the road. I think there's no way to predict when these kinds of consequences might come to bear, and some of them might come to bear more earlier in the process and others later. You certainly are seeing some adjustment in the dollar versus, or a substantial adjustment, actually, in the dollar versus the euro right now, but without having an adverse effect on interest rates thus far. But I think the real answer to that, or the best answer to that question, is that the probability of all of these kinds of effects happening, it seems to me, is very high. There is no way to predict when it will happen. In the 80s, we had unsound fiscal conditions for many years before the effects took root. That could happen again, or it could happen in much shorter order, and I don't think there is any way to make a sensible judgment as to what the likelihood is on that.
Well, we should continue this conversation at some point in the future. Robert Rubin, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Well, I enjoyed it, and I thank you very much.
Former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, currently Director of Citigroup and author of a new memoir, In an Uncertain World, Tough Choices, From Wall Street to Washington. Earlier in the program, we heard from the New York Times reporter Elizabeth Becker. I want to pass along a special thanks to Ken Beck and everyone at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City, where Robert Rubin was with us. Thanks for the use of your studios and your people as well. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.